Hi, it's No Crumbs Left, and I'm sitting across from Teresa Collins, who is one of my favorite teachers, and she taught both of my kids, and I'm excited to have you here. Tell us a little bit about who are you? What do you do?
Thanks, Terry. I'm so excited to be here because you are one of my favorite parents that I've ever worked with, and your kids are just spectacular people. So thank you for saying that about me as a teacher of your student of your kids, and thanks for having me. I'm an English teacher and have been for over half my life. I started teaching in 1992, which is bananas, and I work at a progressive school, and so I guess the other thing that I would add to my who am I, in addition to being a high school English teacher, is I am a progressive high school English teacher. Progressive education is a really important part of my practice, and it's how I very strongly identify. I'm also a mom of two amazing daughters. I am the oldest of three sisters, and the life partner to my college sweetheart.
I love that.
So that's me.
You guys are such a cute couple. So what does it mean, a progressive education? Of course, I should probably know really the answer to this. I vaguely know it, and having sent my kids through is it 14 years or 12 years?
It's 14.
14
mm-hmm.
years mm-hmm. of progressive education for both of them. But give us the official definition. What does that mean?
So progressive education is I can give you a little bit of a visual. Traditional education is a model where teachers are expecting students to kind of absorb knowledge like a sponge. So the teacher is pouring the knowledge in and the student is soaking it up and sometimes regurgitating it. So if you think about a sponge filling up with water and then squeezing it out, that is a really basic description of traditional education. And there's nothing really wrong with traditional education. I was educated in public schools my whole life, and yet progressive education sees teachers and students as co-creators of knowledge. And so there is a sense that teachers and students are co-constructing knowledge together. For me, in the English classroom, what that means is if we're reading a text, if the students are writing about a text, I'm not giving them all the same question to answer. We're constructing questions together so that they can individually take a look at. We're looking at The Great Gatsby right now, actually, with my 11th grade class. And today, the students went around the room and everybody shared a quote. Everyone shared a completely different quote, and then they had to come up with something else that they want to follow in the text. So progressive education for me is right there in a nutshell. It's the teacher presenting and facilitating a learning experience and then allowing, inviting the students in to be part of the process from there. So we kind of set the conditions for the learning because we're the experts in the content, but then we invite the students to join us in that expertise and to build their own, hopefully, in addition to expertise and skills, but maybe even a little bit of a passion for something in particular by the time they finish with us.
And when you say, you know, progressive and private, are there teachers who are at a public school who may be teaching a progressive curriculum?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I believe that I've been a progressive educator for my entire career. I just didn't really know that there was a specific history, philosophy. You know, John Dewey is the person that most people think about. So in my own teacher education, I was never really aware of the radical ideas of John Dewey. But I absolutely have always been very student-centered, very choice-based, and very much focused on helping the students think about who they are going to be beyond the classroom.
Wow. So what does it mean to – what makes you a teacher?
I think – what makes me a teacher is a combination of things. It's the way that I am really actually blessed to be able to bring a passion for everything related to literature, reading, writing, speaking, and then to present that content to a group of students to help them not just learn about books, not just learn about characters, not just learn about how to write for an audience and to communicate with language, but to teach students, to teach young people that reading and writing and speaking are tools that they're going to use for their entire lives. So they might not become the biggest lovers of the fiction of Toni Morrison. They might not become lifelong pleasure readers, but hopefully they'll come away with an understanding. This is what I want them to know. This is what I'm hoping I'm teaching them, that language matters, that words matter, and that we have choice about what we say and how we say it. And that's really, really powerful. So I think that's what makes me a teacher, in addition to my credentials, in addition to my position at the school. But in all of my work with adolescents and with adults, you know, my goal is to help people understand the way that language has power.
And so how might that play out in a curriculum? Like if you're reading a particular book, or how does that, can you take us through a lesson or how you might incorporate that into teaching?
Yeah, absolutely. We are, you know, again, I'm always thinking about how to make the reading relevant to the student. So as I think about, I'm teaching Of Mice and Men, which is, you know, just a classic little tiny novel. And so we are looking at the issue of power within the characters and how certain characters use or hold their power, where power is used for negative reasons to hurt, and when power is used for positive reasons to build and connect. So we typically start with the characters in the books, and this is why I love teaching English in particular, because it's so much easier, especially for teenagers, to think about and talk about a character and a situation in a book really deeply, really thoroughly. They think about it, they write about it, they talk about it, and then we get to a place where we can move the questions to, okay, so where have you seen examples of people misusing power? Where have you seen examples of people using power to build and to help? And that's how my teaching is progressive, and it's also how I help the students see it's about more than the book. It's about life.
Right. Well, one thing is, you know, for both of my kids, I think you were such a powerful influence. I always loved the come to parent night where we'd come and see, you'd lay everything out of what people were reading for the year. And, you know, some of the things that I like doing is like when your kid's in high school and then they're a little beyond like, you know, wanting you to hold their hand as they come into school and everything, is reading the books that you had selected so that if they're reading it, I would know, and they would be the kinds of things, you know, that we could have conversations about. It was just kind of a way to connect, you know, connect to their world. I think there's something that you do is that you really do it with love. I mean, I think it's something you and I have in common, which is really probably why we connect, because we are leading with our hearts.
Absolutely.
And we're doing it with love. So just let's talk a little bit about that. And why is that important in your work or in anything you do?
Yeah, I really agree. You know, I love, you know, I would like to think that someday I'll be, you know, a great cook, a great chef like you are. But what I love about watching you and learning from you is that you do lead with your heart. And I read a number of years ago, there's a book called Teaching to Transgress by Bell Hooks. And she's a pretty renowned scholar. And it was the first book I read about teaching in which the writer was saying, you have to love, because if you don't love, if you don't open your heart, then you can't ever really make the deep connection of trust that's needed in order for learning to take place. You have to love because you must be able to create an atmosphere that feels safe, where students can bravely take a risk. And seeing all of the children in the classroom as my children is also a really powerful lesson that I learned in the early 90s when the school that I used to work at was diving deeply into what we could do about the opportunity and achievement gap. And I'll never forget reading a data set that said, you know, some high percentage of students felt like their teacher didn't like them. And as a result, they didn't feel prepared to learn. They didn't want to learn. And that really shook me. It really shook me to my core. And it was before I had my own children. But in that moment, I realized I needed to change. And I needed to be much more conscious of how I was showing up, not to the kids, but for the kids on their behalf. Right. So that for me, it has to start with love. of my content, of the students, of the process, everything.
I mean, because you've been doing this a long time, yet you're so inspired about what you're doing. And people often ask me, like, how are you still inspired about cooking? I mean, for me, it's a lifelong study. It's what I love to do. I've been working on this book tour, and I've had to do different kind of work where it's like we're calling, we're talking to people all day about finding spots. Well, by 5 o'clock, I'm so exhausted. Like I want to lay in bed and I want to curl up. But it's interesting because when I'm cooking and blogging and things like that, I could literally do that till midnight and feel so fueled and all of that. So, you know, we know that loving what we do is really important. And how does that translate into your teaching? I mean, how does that help you inspire kids or help you to, you know, for these kids, for them to find it for themselves.
Yeah, I'm thinking about myself walking around my classroom, and just this morning, you know, one of the things we do every day at the start of every single class that we have is I give the students 6 minutes of uninterrupted private writing. And so as the kids are getting ready or not getting ready, I'm walking around and I'm saying things like, come on, honey, let's get your notebook out, or I'm touching someone on the shoulder. Or this morning, one of my juniors was saying, it's already been a day. And I'm like, it's 10 o'clock in the morning. What are you talking about? What do you need? Let's get it out. So I'm meeting them where they are emotionally, because you don't always walk into the room or a transition ready to do the thing that you're there for. So I'm allowing them to transition into my space and giving them a thoughtful moment before we dive in to the work. So I think that's a loving gesture, you know, recognizing that this world is ours, you know, for the 50 minutes that we're there together. I try to learn a little something about the students, who they are outside of the classroom. I try to notice a necklace that they're wearing or a change in their hairstyle. I try to affirm the ideas that they're bringing into the classroom space by reflecting what they've said and pointing out, that was an amazing question. I'm so glad you picked that quote. It's my favorite quote in the whole novel. What made you pick it? So that we're connecting, and if I'm really on my game, then I'm connecting things that students say to each other so that they can begin to build the conversation that I'm modeling. So I want to create a community where scholarship is fun, but it's based in the connection that we have with each other.
Right. What happens when you've got a student that's difficult?
And
yeah, because we know that happens. So what?
Right,
yeah,
right.
Like, how do you find inspiration there, or how do you not just totally lose your patience?
Right,
there?
That is so hard. And I mean, I have probably 7 in my brain right now over the years that I can think about, and it's an area that I'm absolutely still working on. But it is calling in patience and recognizing this one might not be in love with what we're doing together, and that's okay. But there's something that this one is in love with, and I'm thinking about one right now. He is a noodle of a child. I mean, he is just, it's every other day, can we just watch the movie of this? Right? Do we have to do this? And so he's not like bad.
Right.
He's just not feeling really engaged. But he, when he stands up in the class to present something, to read a poem, his, you know, stage presence, I'm making air quotes because it's really my classroom, is amazing. The tone of his voice changes. The way he stands in the room changes. And he's part of one of the choral groups. And he's, you know, he's a younger student. He's a younger high school student. And I just talk to him about singing, and I talk to him about his presence, as opposed to, why don't you do your homework?
Right.
You are really behind on this stuff, you know. Entering the relationship where I know a child has strengths and maybe even an emerging passion is where I try to go with students who are difficult.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. I love that. So what makes you a learner? Are you still a learner? And what's
totally.
Yeah. Talk to us about that.
Totally. I wouldn't say I'm the best learner in terms of new books, because I tend to love to go back to my old standards. So especially since I'm 48, I've been doing this for a really, really long time, and my kids are getting older. We were talking about this before. It's really important to have anchors outside of your profession. And so I follow your recipes. I have been looking at different resources for, you know, different kinds of nonfiction writing or essays or podcasts. So I'm trying to reach out and broaden my scope in terms of listening to the world and different ideas about the world through a bunch of different podcasts that I listen to. I try to stay active outside of school, and I'm thinking about getting a puppy this summer. And so when I got my first dog, I spent months reading up about how to take care of poodles, and so I'll probably engage in that again. But really, as opposed to the content of teaching English, I feel like I'm working more on learning about the students and just spending much more time on those relationships.
I think it's important. I mean, my parents were always, learners. They were always like reaching out. They had a lot of very young friends of all ages. My mother had a lifelong passion with music. So sort of what I do with food is what my mother did with music. And I saw her entire life pursuing music, having a band. She was in a band for literally 50 years with her best friends. And for me, cooking is that. It's a lifelong passion. I love it. And it's just always learning more and finding out something, a way to cook something. Or someone said today, well, do you ever put garlic in your chicken broth? And I was like, well, when I make my spicy broth, I do.
Yeah.
But when I'm just making a solid chicken broth, I don't, for whatever reason. But I was like, but you should definitely try it, because it could be, it could be fantastic.
Yeah.
So I think that is the thing, is that we're all learning all of the time. And what are, just talk about igniting that love of learning with your kids in your class, or your kids in your own life, your two children.
Oh, my gosh. Though, I feel like it's easier with the kids in my class. But I did want to say, when you were talking about your mom it really sounds like you learned how to learn from your mom, because you don't do the same stuff that she did, but you're pursuing in the same way that she did. And I wanted to call that out, because I think that's something that, especially for parents, some of us have a vision on who we think our children are supposed to be. And I think the most important gift that we can give our kids, that it sounds like you definitely got from your parents, and in this case, your mom, is that just being the model is sometimes enough, and being able to notice that. So I think that's really wonderful.
Yeah, I definitely grew up in a family where my parents didn't have an expectation of who we would be.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have an expectation for us on what grades we got. Their expectation was that we would really try, and we would give things 150%, that we just would give our full selves to things. But we didn't have an expectation. My dad wound up with a lot of artists as grandkids, and he really celebrated that. So that was modeled for me, and the same thing was for my kids. I mean, with Lucy, after 2 years in school, she left. We didn't make a permanent decision, but she left for that time, and that's the same with Patrick. And of course, I wanted my kids to finish and to do that. Interestingly enough, it wasn't something that I finished.
Yeah.
But it is something that if they have the opportunity to. But here's the reality: is we have to champion our kids who they are and celebrate it.
Right. I was hoping you would say champion, because that's one of my favorite words that you use, and I think of you every time I think of what it means to champion somebody. You asked about how I ignite learning. Gosh, I try to provide a little sense of mystery and enticement. So the other day, one of my students said, "What are we reading next after The Great Gatsby, Mrs. Collins?" And I said, "We are reading a book about murder, oil, wealth, and moonshine." And they were like, "What?" And so I try to, provide little teasers like that. But as I said before, it providing relevant and meaningful feedback, much more than, "Hey, that's awesome," is really, really important, because teenagers aren't fools. They want to know why you like the thing that you said you liked about their work. They want to understand how to make it better. I think at root bottom, the students, at least in my experience, they know that they're in a place where they are supposed to perform, please, whatever you want to call it. And so being specific about the feedback that I provide, I think is an extension of the continual invitation into learning. You can do this. This is good thinking, and we're going to work on it more, and I'm going to help you do this. I'm here with you right right through the whole process from beginning to end. And, you know, you have to be a little bit of a show person in front of the students.
Right.
I mean, they have a the most bizarre schedule in the world, and they're coming from physics or PE or whatever else they're coming from, a fight with their friend, and you have to get them centered and into the moment. So it's, you know, it's important to kind of have that on display, which can be a little tiring from time to time, but it's totally worth it.
And I know that you have everything you do with the school that you work at, but I know beyond that, you're a part of, on a global level or on a larger level, progressive education. And talk to me about what is it that you do there.
I am, I'm currently the, I lead the board of directors of the Progressive Education Network. And the cool thing about this organization is that it actually, there was a version of it that was started by John Dewey in the early 1900s. And it was called the Progressive Education Association. And over the years, there were different iterations of it. Different things happened. It kind of fell apart, got back together, fell apart, got back together. And in the early 2000s, a group of my colleagues were at a conference out east, and there was this session called Open Space, and there was just a random group of people, and someone said, hey, who wants to restart the Progressive Education Network? They did it, and by 2008, I want to say, they incorporated it as a 501c3, which was a big first. So our organization is, it's a true network, so we have over 3,500 members and counting, and that means there are teachers in individual schools all over the nation and across different places in the world. I just had an email from a gentleman in Puerto Rico yesterday, and then there's a lovely gentleman over in Nepal who sends us his newsletter from time to time, and he's connected to the network. And our goal is to amplify the work of progressive educators wherever they may be, public, private, charter, even parochial schools, colleges, and universities. And we do that in two ways. We provide a biannual conference. Biannual is every other year, right?
Nope. Well, you're asking the wrong person.
So every odd numbered year, we have a national conference in a major city, and we invite people to come and present their work. So we're planning for that this fall in the Twin Cities over the first weekend in October. It typically happens. And then the other thing that we do that I'm much more involved with is I get to teach a 6-day workshop for teachers. And again, they come from all over the nation. And this year in our cohort, we have a teacher from who works in Dubai.
Wow.
Yeah, so she's going to be coming back over to the United States for another 3 days. And we immerse the teachers in two progressive schools so they have a chance to see how other people do the work in real time.
And so during the 6 days, then they co-teach or they observe at other...
Right. Yeah, they're observing. They're observing at other schools, and we're having conversations with our little cohort of 22 educators. And by the end of the first 3 days at the first school, each person comes up with an action project that they want to pursue in their own work. Then a couple months go by, and we get together again at another school. We sort of reconnect, recharge, talk about the work, immerse and observe in another school setting, and then we have everybody do a final demonstration of learning, which is an articulation of what progressive education means to them. Because one of the things that I've found is that most people think progressive education is sort of this silly, you know, touchy-feely kind of do whatever you want sort of form of learning. And it's so much more than that. So we've had now, we're in our sixth cohort of the National Institute of Penn. So we've got over 100 teachers who have come through, and it's a wonderful new facet to my work as a teacher, because I'm working with adults who I know are then going to have an impact on literally thousands of students all over the world. And it's just really exciting and inspiring, because people come to conferences like ours, and one woman said, this is like the rain you wait for after a drought. It just fills you up and recharges you. And so I feel really lucky to be part of the organization that does that for other people.
Absolutely.
Like me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you do to recharge? Because being a teacher would seem like it would take a lot of energy.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a lot of get up and go all of the time, a lot of just all the different classes, all the different kids, managing all of that. What do you do to stay balanced and to recharge and refresh yourself?
Yeah, I need to be better at that, definitely. But I try every day to walk my dog in the morning. I love being out in the morning when it's quiet. If I have a chance, if I have enough time, I'll go over to the lakefront. Maybe this I'll catch the sunrise. I really enjoy making a meal when I get home. I love the concrete nature of following a recipe, maybe with a little, you know, maybe with a little improv every now and again, but just going from a group of raw ingredients to a beautifully arranged plate of food is really meditative to me.
Yeah.
You know, I really love to bake, but it's been a long time since I've baked. So I love cooking. I repotted a fig the other day and it was just it was awesome smelling the dirt, you know, in this interminable winter that we have. So it's those little things. Sometimes just sitting with a glass of wine with Chris in the same room. Is enough.
Lovely. It's lovely. I'm reading The Big Magic with Elizabeth Gilbert. And it's all about creativity and how important creativity is and, you know, stoking your own creativity. And that is a great book to read.
Okay.
It would be an amazing book for your students.
I have to check it out.
She wrote Eat, Pray, Love.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But it's just how to live creativity for creativity's sake and sort of all of the things that you can come up with in your own mind. I think it's just an amazing book. It was sort of big 2 years ago. I'm always about 2 years behind on shoes and on books. What are you reading that you or you've read or what should everyone read that you're reading or have read?
I would love it if everyone picked up a copy of They're There by Tommy Orange. He is a Native American writer, and a student actually gave me the book as a thank you gift, which I always love because it's the one way that I can read something that I might not ordinarily pick up. And it is a story about the urban Indian experience, and he weaves together a tapestry of narratives is the only way I can describe it. And it taught me about this slice of experience in American life that I had no idea about. And so that, you know, and I don't think a lot of people know a whole lot about the Native American experience, much less the urban Native American experience. So They're There by Tommy Orange is awesome.
Glad to
and
know.
Everyone should read it.
I'm so glad to know.
Everyone.
One of the things I've done for myself this year is I've got myself a membership to Audible, and I've made the commitment to like the year, so it's like 22 books. So that's really been fun because I actually, kind of like Lucy, prefer a story being told to me than to read.
Nice.
But it's kind of a wonderful way to go to sleep or wake up or take a break or if I'm traveling or whatnot, is to hear a beautiful story being told.
And is that, I mean, when you fall asleep you're hearing it, do you pick up where you left off?
I do.
Are you able to remember?
What I do is I take a screenshot of where I am.
Okay.
I put a sleep timer on and then I just always go back to where I was.
That's awesome.
And we're usually rotating a personal growth book and then another book. And then I kind of go back and forth. Sometimes I might have three or four books because when I get to a part that's kind of upsetting, it's difficult for me to go forward. It is my relaxation. And then when I know this like really upsetting thing's going to happen, a lot of times I do a story and say, is anyone reading this book?
Right.
Because I need to know what the next chapter is going to be because I can't actually read this chapter. So is it okay if I skip ahead? And because then I get stopped, you know, but I love, it's so nourishing.
What do you mean when you say a personal growth book? What does that mean?
Oh, so it's like, let's say what am I reading right now? Well, like this book about creativity.
Okay.
So that's to me, it's a personal growth book because it's just a book about, it's not a fiction book. It's just like giving you, it's teaching you something new and having you look at something in a different way. So one's going to be just purely fiction or an autobiography. And then the other one's just going to be giving new information about how to live more fully.
So do you feel like you're still a work in process?
Oh, my gosh. Absolutely. I am absolutely still a work in progress. And I'm still working on myself, still figuring it out, you know, how to live my best life, you know, how to do it all because, you know, I mean, I'd had years of working and then I had years of mothering. And, you know, then I, when I was divorced, it was like, then I, you know, was like back to not working. So doing this thing I'm doing, I never planned to be a food blogger. I mean, never said, right. Oh, I'm going to do this. It was just like, I'm a girl that likes to eat. I mean, I would never have planned to, you know, have someone call me an author. Absolutely not. You know, but it happened because my kids were ready for their next chapters. And I was like, there's going to be something more for me. And I don't know what that looks like.
Yeah.
But I never planned to have like a full time job and, you know, be, you know, going on a 20 city book tour. No, never. So I'm always still working on myself.
Yeah.
All the time.
I'm so proud of you.
Thank you.
I mean, it's just it's really, you know. It makes me feel like your biggest intention, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but as I listen to you, your biggest intention is just to keep being.
It's just, you know what I mean? It's getting through each day. But yes, it really is. And it's been, you know, I'm a person who loves working, so it's been really fun to rediscover and mm-hmm. to have it happen, you know, as my chapter 2.5. It's been really, really fun, and I'm just having a great time.
Chapter 2.5. How many chapters do you think you're going to have?
Isn't that a good question? I don't know. I hope a lot. I want to have a lot of chapters with Roy. You know, Lucy went off, and I've been talking a lot about this idea of letting go and holding on with kids, mm-hmm. like when they're little and we hang on, and then they get bigger. As they get bigger, you've got to really start to let to go. And then the best way to really hang on when they're older is to let go, you know,
right.
is to trust them and to know that they can do it and to believe in them. But, you know, then so she left, and that's, you know, the first couple of days it's hard, you know, because I love being with my children.
Yeah.
You know, they are my heart outside my body. But then I say, I've got this great life, you know, I have a wonderful business. I'm with a man I'm crazy about. And, you know, then I just jump into that and I see what's next. And when people say, well, what do you think you're going to be doing in 5 years? The truth is, if you'd said to me 5 years ago, you're going to be doing this, I would have said, you're 100% wrong. It's absolutely not happening.
Right. Yeah.
So I just keep thinking, if you're doing, you know, you do the next right thing and you have trust and you kind of stay in your own lane and not worry too much about what everybody else is doing, you know, that somehow it's going to work out. So far, it's been good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what else? Where can people find you?
People can find me probably, well, they can definitely find me on Twitter.
Okay.
@ SquiresTC. And then the Progressive Education Network has an Instagram that could definitely use some love.
Okay. So what is there? What's that Instagram?
Oh, my goodness. I think it's @ Progressive Ed Picks or @ Progressive Ed Network. Maybe we should write it down on the blurb.
Well, we're going to find out.
I'm in airplane mode, so I can't check right now.
What in closing, what tips would you have for parents? You know, and I'm sure parents ask you all the time, especially in high school.
Mm.
What is the best way to support your kids, and especially as learners in
mm-hmm.
school?
Mm-hmm. That's a really great question. One answer mirrors your image of letting go to hold on. School is the second most important context of a child's life, especially adolescence life. Family is the first one. But school is a place, especially for teenagers, where parents are just going to need to expect unfinished business, reduced amounts of communication, and so they need to let go of the expectation that they're going to hear about every single detail in their child's life. That being said, asking a good old-fashioned open-ended question about some element of the day, or even what are you reading and what is it making you think about, is a great way to start. Then the other piece, I think, because it is, you know, we are talking about a time of life where students have to be in school. This is the moment where we can really keep a close watch on them just to make sure they're steering in the right direction. I think having a mindset of growth and development that's geared towards whatever future might be in store for their student is much better than trying to think about a very specific path. So are they going to have the tools and skills in order to get to the next step? Is that going well? Are they learning how to learn? what can I do to be supportive of what's happening in the classroom, as opposed to having a really strong focus on things like grades or GPAs. Who is my child as a learner, and are there things that they need extra help with, and what do I need to do to help them? I wish parents didn't feel the pressure that we feel to get our kids to a very specific next step in life. But we do. So I guess that's the best tip. It's try to find ways to let go, to hold on, but engage with those questions that are an invitation as opposed to a judgment. Why didn't you do that? What do you think about this? Why do you think you have to take physics now? I know it's kind of hard on you, but what do you think the purpose is of this education that you're getting? How can I help you? Those kinds of things, I think, are a little bit more important. Would you like to share with me the details of your day?
Right.
Give them the option.
Right. And what do you do with those parents that they're just pushing their kids sort of in a way, it's like to be that perfect whatever, mm-hmm. This idea of what they want, in a way that it doesn't support the kids. What do you do about that? Can you do anything? Do you talk to the parents about it?
It really depends on the kind of relationship mm-hmm. that I have with the parent. So I think in my role as an advisor, there are families with whom I have a much more extended relationship, so that I have been able to have those conversations. Like, hey, it's really time for you to back off, because this child is under a ton of stress, and it's not coming from the classroom, it's coming from you. So I feel as though I'm veteran enough that and I have raised my own
right.
children to teenager and young adulthood, so I feel like I've got the status and the gravitas to say those kinds of things. But in other cases, Terry, I've got students who are ninth graders who are taking test prep classes for the ACT and the SAT. I think that is bonkers. And the stress that I see on these young children, I think 13, 14 is too young for that. I try to just focus on the child. And so when they walk in the door talking about the test prep session that they just came from, or when they have a really outsized reaction to a low test score, or maybe feedback on a paper that they don't think it's fair, and why didn't I get an A? It's kind of like I just try to focus on where they are, what they need, try to convince them it's not about the grade. It is not about the product. It's about the process, and we're in it together, and this is where we have to focus. That's what I try to do, and I have to tell you, sometimes it feels harder and harder to do that, but I try to just control what I can control.
Well, what I want to say in closing is that you're an amazing teacher. I'm going to kind of tear up.
No, me too.
Yeah, you were such an amazing teacher for Lucy, just like she loves you with her whole heart.
Oh, my goodness.
I love how, Lucy has other people that she can go to who are really wonderful, who have her back, who, love her, who champion her. I remember Maria LaBella, who was a teacher at Parker, said, the goal for her was to really fall in love with her students.
Oh, wow.
And that was certainly the goal for her child, that she hoped that he had those experiences with teachers. So
yeah.
I think teachers make such a difference. You know that I'm all about the unsung hero teachers.
Totally.
And nurses and all of that. So, thanks for what you do to make a difference. And you really, really do inspire, kids in their lives. And I know you're close to these kids that come back.
Oh,
and,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I know I've thanked you for Lucy before, but what I love about these kinds of connections is that now I feel like I'm in a place where I'm going to go to Lucy for things,
right.
as much as she comes to me. And that is just so special.
Yeah.
And, I have you to thank for that. And I'm so grateful.
Yeah, thank you.
So it's all mutual.
I love it.
Me too.
Everybody have a great day. Come over and find me at No Crumbs Left. And definitely subscribe to the podcast.